A year ago this month, President Johnson described 1963 as the most prosperous year in our history. If so, 1963's record was short-lived. For the year just passed added an extra layer of frosting to the cake. The gross national product, the key index of our economic well-being, grew during the year at a comfortable rate of some 4%, its steepest rate of climb in the past dozen years. At year's end, the major indicators of our stock market were at or near all-time high, indicating not only record corporate profits, but that the financial community was confident that our good fortune would last well into 1965. Now, prosperity is always welcome. Good fortune always is. But it became increasingly clear during the last year that America's good fortune, though it was widespread, was not universal. 9,500,000 American families, one in every five, supported itself on an income of less than $3,000 a year. Though our economic growth permitted the development of 1,500,000 new jobs during 1964, 4 million Americans were unemployed, 5% of our total labor force. There was a comfortable America enjoying all the decencies, and there was a disadvantaged America. Of gray tenements and cold water flats, of endemic unemployment, where the children knew on an average 3 warm meals a week, where the children received the equivalent of 9 years of schooling and during those 9 years mastered the equivalent of a third grade education. Jesus is reported as having said by the New Testament that the poor shall always be among you. As a comment on the rather crude economy of the Roman world, this bleak observation was fairly accurate. It is no longer so. We have idle plant, and we have vast reserves of stored foodstuff. There are jobs aplenty. It is only that the school dropout is not qualified to be a school teacher or a draftsman or a nurse. It has become clear that a relief check, a subsistence allowance, is not a sufficient campaign against poverty. Poverty means not only inadequate housing and inadequate food, but a blunting of personality. A denial of all the cultural amenities, stagnation, the destruction of motivation. We've come to realize that if we wish to confront seriously this problem of poverty in the midst of abundance, we must attack directly the social blight and the cultural disadvantage which it breeds. Our schools must in many cases take the place of parents, if only to provide the light and the heat in which a child can study. The community must provide job retraining for the manual laborer who has been displaced by automation. And in many cases, it must provide basic courses in literacy and reading skills. There must be counseling advice to the entire family as to the medical and the psychiatric services which are available in a community, as to nutrition, so that the family's horizons can be broadened. Children and adults must be introduced to the world of learning and the world of books. Such a simple thing as adequate speech so that they can make their wishes and their thoughts and their requests for employment understood. We must broaden their horizons. They must come into the American dream. Our Congress during 1963 began at least to recognize this need. Late in the summer, the Economic Opportunities Act, the so-called War on Poverty Bill, was passed. But it is not yet a war on poverty. Perhaps it is best described as a skirmish with poverty. For neither the Congress nor the administration has made it clear that it is willing to invest the huge sums of money, adequate manpower, in order to accomplish the task. Our entire taxing structure will have to be reoriented if this job is to be done. New skills, new professional skills will have to be devised and men and women trained at great cost. And the constant complaints of the thin-lipped and the selfish, those who have none of the simple milk of human kindness, will have to be met and put down. But there is a job to be done. We can only hope and pray that the war on poverty is something more than a piece of campaign sloganry. It is indeed a priority of this present administration. If we are somewhat unclear as to the urgencies of this administration's great society, this is true of most of its policies. Rarely has a new administration taken office with the public so uncertain as to its basic point of view. This is largely due to the nature of the past election. Senator Goldwater may have voiced many of the hesitancies and the frustrations, many of the prejudices and much of the belligerency of some Americans. But he failed utterly to suggest alternative choices. There was no debate, there was no focus to the election campaign. There was no challenge. And the president was able to slip through on the issue of prosperity. No one wanted to rock the boat, and claiming to himself the mantle of President Kennedy's programs. This is unfortunate. A democracy requires this quadrennial exercise in self-awareness, an updating of its thinking. An administration must be challenged, however successful, to justify its policies and to make clear its programs. And this justification simply did not take place. It was simply not required by the election campaign. The election campaign of 1964 had one other unfortunate effect. It seriously weakened our two-party system of government. The Republicans chose to run a man who was a minority choice within their own party. And the results of the election carnage are well known. The Republican Party today controls less than one seat in four in the Congress. Only 17 of the 50 governor's chairs. And they lost control of two-thirds of the state legislatures where they had till now been rather safely entrenched. And with the courts enforcing statewide reapportionment, their losses will be greater still. Now a nation requires a party that challenges, a loyal opposition. The last campaign taught us that the out party, the minority party, must raise a serious campaign. It must challenge the basic assumptions of a present administration so that a consensus can be evolved, so that the people, as it were, can listen to the problems and make up their collective minds. Unfortunately, there is no indication as yet that the Republican Party has learned the lesson of its lack of citizenship. There was much talk after the election of an agonizing reappraisal. But as far as I have been able to see, this agonizing reappraisal has deteriorated into a hunt for the scalp of the chairman of the Republican National Party Committee. The Republican Party, unfortunately, seems to include a heavy percentage of heavy contributors who would rather be doctrinarily consistent than politically effective. I'm afraid that the grand old party is suffering from an aggravated case of hardening of the arteries. And unless there is a serious injection of youth and a vigor, of a new seriousness, of a new sense of national purpose, I would not be at all surprised if in the next 4 years, or in the next decade at least, a new second party would emerge on the American scene. Democracy requires it. The people will see to it that if the minority party, as it is now constituted, defaults on its responsibilities, a new opposition will be created. The campaign of 1964 also introduced a new term into our vocabulary. It was the term backlash. It is a creation of the pollsters, by the way, a linguistic monstrosity. It is by way of being a euphemism to describe the prejudiced white man who was prepared to vote against that political party which was seeming to give added opportunity to the Negro. Backlash became popular when Governor Wallace of Alabama was campaigning in Wisconsin and Indiana and Maryland and gaining quite a vote, lacking every important credential for a president's campaign except his demagoguery on the issue of race. Fortunately, when the chips were down, when America knew that it was voting for a candidate and not simply not voting its peeve, backlash evaporated. But not before it had two serious and deleterious side effects. It misled the Republican Party as to its campaign strategy, to the confusion of the Republican Party. And it caused all of us to concentrate our thinking on white confusions rather than on Negro progress. Somehow the symbol of the civil rights struggle during 1964 was the image of a pollster interviewing a white housewife on a city stoop and listening to her uncertainty about the possibility of a Negro family moving into the neighborhood. Now this turning in upon our own uncertainties and ambivalence in the area of race was unfortunate. Not only because it gave to these uncertainties a dignity which they did not deserve, but because it caused us to overlook some major progress in the area of civil rights. During 1964, the 24th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States became law, an amendment which prohibits the poll tax. During 1964, the President of the United States signed an executive order ordering the various departments of our government to cut off the flow of funds to any agency, to any state, to any building contractor, to any institution, to any hospital, to any school which discriminated in its policies of admission or of residence or of sale. Prejudice was going to have to pay a most high price. Early in 1964, you'll recall, the civil rights people took to the streets, and their voice was heard. For by late summer, the Congress had finally blasted loose from committee President Kennedy's civil rights bill, and it was passed. And in the passing, it became the law of the land that no one of color could, or for any reason, could be refused residence in a hotel or a seat in a restaurant simply because of his color. that the United States government could take certain action against unions which barred Negroes from their membership, that the United States government would initiate action against school boards and school systems which had separate rules for pupil placement for the colored and for the white, and that the United States government could initiate action against voting registrars who had separate requirements for the voting enrollment of Negro and of the white. I think few of us have really recognized the importance of the Civil Rights Bill. It marks, in my humble opinion, a judicial watershed in our legal development. For when the Supreme Court of the United States upheld the constitutionality of the public accommodations title of this act late in the year, it said, in effect, that though throughout our history the courts have held sacrosanct the rights of private property, it has come to realize, the courts have come to realize, that in holding these rights sacrosanct, the law has in effect been a shield and a prop to the inherited patterns of prejudice within a city. A man could say to the Negro who stood before the registration desk, "If you don't get out of here, I'll call the police and I'll have you arrested of trespass." Now a public business must be public. Now, in effect, the courts are saying private property is not that sacrosanct that it can interfere with the rights, the normal rights of all Americans to their dignity and to their full opportunity. In effect, the courts have moved the law over to the side of the civil rights people. They have opened up the law to give to the outraged and to the distressed and to the pushed out regress and redress. And in effect, we now have a civil rights struggle of Americans, with Americans, for American decency, rather than a racial revolution which must batter against the door, beat down the law, and use the heavy club of civil disobedience as the only tool which it has to win the day. When President Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, he said that this act is intended not to divide, but to end division. In my humble opinion, the act goes far towards making this dream of a united and free America possible. There has been progress in the area of civil rights in 1964, but that is not to say that the civil rights struggle is won. It's hardly begun. Washington has acted. Cleveland has barely stirred. There has been ugliness, and there has been violence, and there will be ugliness, and I'm afraid there will be further violence. But the law has swung to the side of the petitioner, of the man in need. Human rights take precedence over property rights. America will slowly emerge from this period of contortion, of turmoil, and of trouble. There was ugliness in the racial picture in 1964. One bit sticks to mind. The scene is a Mississippi courtroom. Byron de la Beckwith is to be tried for the murder of the NAACP leader and organizer Medgar Evers. The prosecutor is seeking to impanel a jury. The prosecutor turns to a prospective juror and he says to him, "Do you believe that it is a crime in Mississippi for a white man to kill a Negro?" The juror is silent. The judge leans over to the prosecutor and said, "What did the juror say?" "Nothing, judge. He's trying to make up his mind." While many white men In some parts of America were trying to make up their mind that the Negro was in fact a man. Many of color throughout the world had made up their mind that the white man was no longer going to be the dominant force in our world. Increasingly, race has become a crucial psychological dividing point in international affairs. And I'm afraid we overlook this to our own hurt. Early in the year, Chou En-lai told his 700 million fellow Chinese that the Soviet Communist Party leadership was seeking to effect a Soviet-American accord in order to dominate the world. Imagine the paranoia which is behind this charge of conspiracy. That somehow the two great opposing forces of the world are meeting secretly and clandestinely in order to dominate the world. To dominate whom? The colored man, the man of color. Only a racial concern, a racial paranoia could have assumed that this kind of conspiracy could in fact exist. And yet Chou En-lai spent the better part of the year traveling to Indonesia, to Cairo, to Dark Africa, to peddle exactly this racist theory. I've long believed that race lies at the very base of the Sino-Soviet split. That split is historically explainable as a battle over the great center heartlands of Asia. There has been battle also for spheres of influence in India and in Southeast Asia. But I think the venom with which it is being fought, a venom hardly masked by their joint communist ideology, can be explained only on the psychology of race. Race played a major and unfortunate part in our world's affairs during 1964. Early in the year, race certainly was the catalyst, the dynamite cap, which exploded the Yankee go home cries of the mob in Panama. Race is certainly at the basis of the charges which have been made so dramatically and so forcefully and so overstatedly in the United Nations against the United States and against Belgium because of the Mercy airlift of last month. Why are the dark nations of Africa so opposed to Mr. Tshombe, who is himself, after all, a man of color? Not because he was the front man to Belgian mining interests in Katanga 3 years ago. Many of the African leaders were in the government of a colonial power before their nation achieved freedom. But rather because when he came back to power in August of this year, once the United Nations troops had been removed from the Congo, he solidified his power by hiring mercenaries. And whom did he hire? Whites. Whites from what nations of the world? From the Union of South Africa, and from Southern Rhodesia, the two great nations which insist on racial apartheid. And why was the United States blackened with this tar? Because we had been consistently supporting Mr. Tshombe? Why were we blackened for our mercy airlift? Because the blacks of Africa accuse us of a racially selective moral outrage. Early in the year, there was bloodshed between Arab and Negro in the island of Zanzibar. And no one in the United States suggested a mercy airlift. Later in the spring, there was an uprising of religiously fanatic tribespeople in Kenya and Uganda. There was great bloodshed. And no one in the United States suggested a mercy airlift. There has been, throughout the year, bloodshed and bloodletting between the various tribes of the little nation of Rurundi, between the pygmy and the giant tribes. And no one in the United States suggested an airlift. There has been vast bloodletting in the Congo over the past 4 years. And only when there were white hostages, only when white men's lives were in danger, did the United States bestir itself for an airlift. Now, we know the decencies of our own foreign policy. We know our foreign aid program. We know how we have been a sturdy supporter of the United Nations. We know the tens of thousands of acts of mercy of which individual Americans and our organizations have been responsible. The black man sees only the overly simple fact that a white skin seems to be worth more than a black one. And believe me, Mr. Chiu En Lai, Mr. Nasser, and Mr. Ben Bella, and the others who are trumpeting this racist line are making the most of this morally selective, racially selective, moral outrage of ours. And when Chiu En Lai speaks, he speaks now with an added force. For on the 16th of October of the last year, China exploded a nuclear device. She joined the so-called nuclear club. Her voice will be heard not only because of the vast population which is hers, but because of the power which will soon be hers. And with that explosion, so many of the pretensions of our policy these past decade went up in smoke. We are very proud of the year ago when we finally engineered, after years of patient conference, the Limited Test Ban Treaty in Geneva. It means nothing now. It's a scrap of paper. Chinese nuclear ash will be in the air, is now in the air. French fallout will soon be in the air. How long will it be before Yugoslavia or in Egypt joins in nuclear testing? The chances of international holocaustal war are now, I am afraid, infinitely more probable. We had a decade and a half at the end of the Second World War in which there were only two great powers. These powers were in confrontation. But we had the chance, when world politics were relatively simple, to organize so the instrumentalities of world peace. But the key fact of the last years has been the decentralization of power. And this decentralization is, in fact, a fact as nations join the nuclear club. France is walking her own way in the West. China has walked her own way in the East. The NATO nations are increasingly restive under our strategic leadership. And the Warsaw Pact nations are increasingly restive under Russian leadership. The world seems to me to have returned to its condition in 1910 or in 1930. A congeries of bickering, quarreling nations, each after its own individual greeds and needs. And the world has few, if any, instrumentalities and institutions which can band these nations together and give to all of us some chance of peace. We missed a golden opportunity in these last 20 years to build peace. The task will now be infinitely the more difficult. And frankly, I have not seen any of the great leaders of our world, of any nation, come up with the crash program, the philosophical priority, which would insist that peace is the essential need of the world, and that his nation is prepared to give up this and this of its sovereignty, this and this of its traditional prerogative, if only the other nations will go along to strengthen the United Nations or some other instrumentality of world law, world order. Those of us who dream of peace had nightmares during 1964. We saw in 1964 the decentralization of power. We saw the growing lack of control and of freedom on the part of both the United States and of the Soviet Union. We saw a little nation like Romania challenge the Soviet on its economic policies, refuse to go along with the decisions of Comecon, the Soviet equivalent of the common market, insists that its economy must go its way alone. Finally, because Khrushchev could not give to the Russians the glory that was Stalin, his neck was on the block, and he fell. And there is a similar pattern of growing weakness within the United States. We too have had to pull in our horns. We too can no longer make half the world dance to our tune. And I'm afraid we have not yet admitted that fact to ourselves. Surely the headline fact of this new weakness is our failure in Indochina. Surely it has become clear by December of 1964 that the Indochinese military adventure was a mistake from the beginning. We had no reason to try and pull the French coals out of the fire after Dien Bien Phu almost a decade ago, and that we've not been able to pull it off. I know of no other American military undertaking which was from the beginning so obtusely and inadequately handled. No one made clear to the American people why we were moving into Southeast Asia in the first place. We had no traditional interests in the area. After the French pulled out, there seemed some hope for a basic neutralization of the area against its being brought into the Cold War. We certainly did not move into South Vietnam in order to protect democracy and freedom. We protected the government of Ngo Diem, an absolutist dictatorship government. Surely we did not go into South Vietnam in order to protect the free enterprise system. South Vietnam's economy is feudal, was and is feudal. What then? I've always suspected that we went into South Vietnam because of a geography lesson, which the erstwhile Secretary of State John Foster Dulles gave to the American people a dozen years ago. Pulled down, as it were, a map on the wall of his office, a map on which all the communist states had been colored in red. And he drew a line around these states, and he said, "Thus far shall they come and no further. And all that is outside this line, we will protect." There were no equivocations. Whatever the kind of government, whatever the quality of the economy, whatever the will of the people there themselves, we will protect them from communist infiltration, from communist influence, from communist attack. We went into South Vietnam for our own geopolitical reasons, not so much for the South Vietnamese benefit, though we have rationalized that, surely. And the results are now patently clear. The general of the South Vietnamese armies has told it to us, point blank. We want no more of your domination. Call back your proconsuls. Let South Vietnam find its own political destiny. The handwriting is on the wall. The Viet Cong, the insurgent force, is outnumbered 5-1. But they have had the major victories. They have conquered new territories. There have been, during 1964, five governmental shakeups in Saigon, and none has been able to gain the support of the Vietnamese peoples. The handwriting is on the wall. I have long publicly urged the neutralization of this entire area. I urge it now, and I urge it before it's too late. President Johnson is today at the apogee of his power. Though it was his administration which only a year ago which had promised to the American people victory in South Vietnam before election time, he can take, I believe, with his current strength, this defeat, this whipping, in stride. Oh, the potential McCarthys will come out of their lairs, and there will be cries of treason and sellout, the usual thing. But I think that the American people are mature enough to understand that the price of escalating the war is not worth the prize. That we would have to commit our entire army to jungle warfare. in the most impassable terrain in the world in order to conquer this nation. And even if we could conquer it, how could we keep it conquered? The countryside supports the Viet Cong. And if we are to take the easy way out, or what the war hawks of our nation tell us is the easy way out, to unleash our atomic reservoir, one of our own homes, what are the possibility of total, worldwide, instantaneous Holocaust? The prize is not worth the price. But I'm afraid we're going to have to make this decision soon, or rather the president is going to have to make it soon. The longer we wait, the more lives that are lost, needlessly. The longer we wait, the more difficult the pullout will be. The stronger the cries of the reactionary, the greater their appeal to the instinctive optimism of an American people which has never known defeat, which does not yet understand that there are strict limitations to American power, or rather that there are strict limitations to our use of our power. ''64, dear friends, was a fat year. 1964 was also a year in which our homes were not directly threatened. Though our professional armies were involved in Southeast Asia, we seemed to be at peace. But there was little joy during 1964. Violence seemed to be the key. Whenever we picked up our morning paper, we read of bloodshed and bloodletting. In Cyprus, the Congo, and Kenya, and Uganda, and Tanganyika, and Zanzibar, in South Vietnam, in Laos, in Indonesia, in Malaysia, in Singapore, in Bolivia, in Venezuela. There was violence. In our own streets, there was violence. I take as symbol of 1964 the exhaustive report of the Warren Commission on the assassination of President Kennedy. Like all modern scholarship, it's complete. It's weighty and extensive. But I submit that after we have read this entire report, after all the facts are known and in, we are not one jot better off as to how to control the pathology and the violence which is all about us. And that is our dilemma as we begin 1965. We live in a world of want. We live in a world where most people are roiling and restless and eager. We live in a world where many peoples are led by megalomaniacs and demagogues. We live in a world which is grasping and it is greedy. We live in a world which is not at peace with its prejudice, but not at peace with its own decency. We have not let yearn for all of our tomes of study, for all of our learning. We have not yet learned how to control this pathology and how to control this violence. We write about it, but frankly, we do pathetic little about it. And that is our challenge. As the new year dawns, we could do no better, you and I, than to rededicate ourselves to the building of wholeness, beginning in our own homes, and the raising of children who are dedicated to things which are decent, who are at peace with themselves, eager only to accomplish, and the building of wholeness into our cities. Decency, the ending of poverty, the ending of that other city, someplace in there, that gray city, where men learn the lessons of the sidewalk and the knife, the law of the jungle, bringing wholeness to our nation, forcing our nation to see beyond the stockpiling of arms and the building of a greater war potential, that the ultimate responsibility of this nation and of all nations must be coexistence, peace, the building of the bridges between nations. 1964 was a sobering year. Yet we are alive. A new year dawns. We can only pray that a kind God who gives us this new year will give us the strength to meet its challenges and to live during the new year with a finer degree of citizenship than even the best citizen among us has shown till now. Amen.